Would you say that the leader represents you all the time?
The Electoral College. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm.
It's not a democratic country, it's a republic.
Republicans and sinners.
But in terms of how people could come to consider it, that's what I meant, as opposed to splitting that hair that Fred just said, that, you know, that major truth that...
Right. Well, that's part of Chapter 7 that we didn't highlight, but is obviously essential there, that these leaders were not, you know, representatives. They were appointed by Rome through a process of political bargaining, negotiation, and violence.
Money.
Money, exactly. So, it's not exactly the same as what we think of as representative leaders, but still they are in that position of authority, however they got to that position.
But even if they are elected and they're representatives of the people, they're not always going to be, not everybody is always going to agree with what they do. And the people will be held responsible or be blamed or be suffer the consequences of whatever the leadership decides.
Right. Yeah.
We see this in Annapolis right now. Who, the Israelis in Annapolis representing Israel are diametrically opposed to what the people want in Israel.
Right.
And what they do, Israel will suffer the consequences of their decisions.
And again, these are political leaders from Israel, not religious leaders. And you'll hear, I think the book even makes a point about this, the difference between Ivri, where he says, you know, I'm not a Jew, I'm a Hebrew. You know, it's I'm not religious. I'm an Israeli. I'm not a Jew.
Right.
So, yeah, it's these people who are in charge of Israel, even though they might have been voted in democratically by the people, have the lowest rating of any government ever in Israel, and they're not necessarily religious people who understand the biblical implications of what they're doing.
Deja vu.
Or maybe they do understand. Maybe it's just like at the time of the crucifixion when the government acted as an arm of the Lord. You know, he decides how it's all going to turn out in that respect. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, any other points that people want to bring up related to this issue?
I wonder, did God decide to punish Israel before that, before the crucifixion and dispersion and destruction?
Did God decide to punish Israel before then?
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, many times. Yeah. What do you mean?
Well, I meant that the rejection, so-called, by the people or by the leaders did not really cause this... you know, devastation and destruction of the temple and dispersion of Jews. That, because this is the main sort of Christian explanation, that Israel has been rejected for that. And now even, you know, in Islam, they consider that their new kind of, the land now, Jews failed, so the land is theirs to possess, you know.
Because they fail to recognize Muhammad.
No, because Jews killed their prophet, and God was angry, and you know, and dispersed them. So now they inherited all the promises.
Because when I read in the Bible about the Tower of Babel, and it really says that you know the different languages and everything, and I said to him, I said, wait a minute, that's not why the Jews are all over the place. It's because of the crucifixion, which is again something that I was taught all the time, and it was news to me that, you know, it wasn't because of that. And you're right. And that is being taught very clearly in the Catholic Church. That is a punishment.
But I kind of think that this is, it was like Nineveh, you know, mm-hmm. since, you know, the punishment was due, and regardless of the crucifixion, basically.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know
because
exactly.
Because their hearts were cold, and because of corruption, because of multiple sins. The same corrupt government, basically, and leaders.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how that works. I mean, Yeshua did say that not one stone would be left on another, and that Jerusalem would be left desolate because it didn't recognize the time of its visitation. So there is some element of truth in it. I don't think it's true in the way that it has been presented in Christianity.
But it came because Israel did not follow really the law of the heart, right? Followed the letter of the law, but not the spirit of the law.
That's one thing that he taught. I don't think that's the only reason he came.
Right, but because there was this spiritual coldness. And
yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that in the case you describe, it's hard to speculate. You know, I don't want to speculate as to what is in God's mind. You know, I think there are a lot of different reasons for the destruction of Israel and the dispersion for 2,000 years, and why he decided to bring the Jews back only in the 20th century for the most part and so forth, even while preserving a remnant for a particular period of time. It's a very mysterious plan in some ways, and a plan that includes the Holocaust and so forth, which some people would also view as, punishment for the sins of the Jews, and other people would very strongly be opposed to that point of view. But to some extent, based on the verses that we have, the destruction that follows may be something along the lines, at least partly, of what was described for David, where the nation as a whole does suffer, even when it may not have been guilty of the sins of the leadership. Yeah.
It's ironic that the destruction of nations follows, you know, they're judging the Jews, you know, like the destruction of Russia and mm-hmm. the destruction of Germany and the destruction of Spain. And pick your nation. When did its destruction occur? It was after they touched the apple of God's eye.
It's hard to make the connection sometimes, but I think that is a biblical principle overall. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
I think that destruction was actually coming, and that event did not delay it or did not make it sooner. It was. I don't think it's a coincidence, but I think it's part. It was part of the whole kind of problem.
Mm-hmm.
Coldness of hearts and the returning away from God.
I mean, historically, without involving biblical reasons, you can explain it in different ways. I mean, the destruction of Jerusalem results from a Jewish war against the Romans, a Jewish revolt against the Romans, which the Romans come in and crush. And then the expulsion of Jews from Judea also results from the same thing, the last revolt against Roman authority. So you can explain it very easily in historical and political terms. It's just that if you read the Bible, you would expect that there is a greater purpose behind anything like that that happens. Unfortunately, as you mentioned, not only was the destruction of Israel seen as a punishment on the Jews for having killed God's son, but also their wanderings throughout the nations was viewed as a sign of God's displeasure, and that they were supposed to be these eternal wanderers kept in a subordinate position as a warning to everyone else, as a sign of what would happen, if you didn't become Christian, basically, if you didn't become Christian. So,
is that the Catholic view?
Well, it's not only the Catholic view. I mean, for example, read what Luther wrote about the Jews, you know, that their synagogue should be burned down with them inside, you know, and their property taken and their houses destroyed and so forth. So, I mean, what we call Catholic is only Catholic because then there were Protestants later on, or because there were the Orthodox that split from the Catholics, and there were the Protestants who split from the Catholics and so forth. Catholic just means universal. So there are a lot of different churches that claim to be Catholic. We refer to the Church of Rome as the Catholic Church, but I mean, in the Orthodox confessions, it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In most of Protestantism, it's the same thing. And what you're referring to in terms of evangelicals today who understand better, it's a very modern thing, you know, and part of a change in understanding that's taken place only really in maybe the 19th and 20th centuries, slowly and gradually. Throughout most of Christian history, there was never any modification of this view, really. The modification of this, of anti-Semitism, tended actually to come from atheistic or anti-religious perspectives who started to view, in the Enlightenment particularly, started to view the whole thing as ridiculous and said, you know, you should actually accept a Jew or a Turk or, you know, a Muslim as your brother. You shouldn't discriminate on these religious bases. So unfortunately, within Christianity, it came very late, the decision to change these understandings.
No, to second guess our Lord Almighty with regard to the Bar Kokhba rebellion. If men were taking God's plan into their own hands and saying, I know a plan, I know what God has in mind, and perhaps God was saying, no, this isn't the time. You must come back to fear of me and obedience to me, and I cannot allow your plan to supersede mine.
Well, in the Bar Kokhba revolt, you also had a false messiah that was promoted. I mean, Bar Kokhba was declared to be the messiah by the leaders of the religious community. And according to some sources, the Jewish believers in Yeshua were slaughtered for not joining in the revolt for this reason, because he was claiming to be the messiah. So there were a lot of different things that were going on in that particular revolt. I think you're right in saying it wasn't God's plan. It was also an attempt to substitute a different type of leader there. Okay, well, anyone else with any comments?
It's just the more I read in this book, the more I understand that the answers are there to the questions. How did we get from the original Bible? How did we get from his word and his way of worshiping, claiming to be, to honor him and to worship him? How did we get to the Christian practices of today? And I you know, and this just kind of fills in that gap as to how did we get from there to here.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I think it has more meaning. I mean, to me, it has a lot of meaning because it explains why it should be the way it was before, and it explains it.
Yeah.
I think if you haven't been on both sides, it's maybe a little harder to understand.
Right.
We don't know God's ways.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the purpose of the book, too, to explain how this shift came about.
Mm-hmm.
Not just the presence of the shift, but how it came about. And also, to go along with that, the need to sort of get rid of the entire framework. Not just, in other words, to keep the Christian framework and to make, you know, minor modifications, to even recognize that it wasn't all Jews who rejected Jesus, or recognize other of the minor points, that the problem, the argument at least that's made in the book, is that the problem is a deeper one. It's the entire system that has been built up. Any theology or any understanding of God's word that doesn't have the Jewish people in the center of his plan is some form of replacement theology. It's some form of a different system, whether or not it's called replacement theology. And you can't get back to the true intention, no matter how many modifications you make, no matter how much closer you get, without being willing to discard that system. And I think, actually, partly that's because of a similar situation that took place within Christianity, where not all Christians, but a very small group of leaders, made some very specific choices that would dictate how all Christians would believe and think and live after that point. And it's very clear in the sources, you know, obviously it started much earlier, but we keep coming back, of course, to the Council of Nicaea in the 4th century, and it's very obvious there what they decided to do. They specifically, I'll not use their words, but I'll translate their words. They specifically said, we're not going to follow what the Bible says. We're going to create a new system. basically, is what they said. And the reason they gave was that they didn't want to be associated with the Jews. So until Christianity, in a sense, repents of that, mm-hmm. or gets rid of that decision, it's not going to be able to have a fully biblical outlook on any of these issues, no matter how many modifications are made. And so I think that, especially within evangelical Christianity, there have been a great number of advancements in terms of coming closer to understanding God's word, and even Jewish roots of Christianity. That whole subject is very popular today and so forth, but it's still not the fundamental transformation. And that's part of the argument of this book, that you have to actually be willing to go back to the original and to look at things from a different perspective without any Christians, you know, without Christianity. That's not the message that's contained in any way. So it's a very different way of looking at mm-hmm. the text.
I want to mention, this is the New King James in its preface, purpose. In the preface to the 1611 edition, the translators of the Authorized Version, known popularly as the King James Bible, state that it was not their purpose to make a new translation, but to make a good one better. Indebted to the early work of William Tyndale and others, they saw their best contribution to consist in revising and enhancing the excellence of the English version, which had sprung from the Reformation of the 16th century.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you read their complete explanation of what they did, you might get a slightly different interpretation of it. But, I mean, obviously they did work with Tyndale's translation. Yeah.
Try talking about some of the things in this book with some of your Christian friends.
Right.
Who don't have a messianic perspective, and see how hostile they get.
Jewish people.
Well, Jewish people tend to be much more open to this because it tends to make sense in terms of, you know, history and language and so forth, and what they know of Jewish history. And it, for those who are more open, it also explains all of the Christian anti-Semitism and, you know, why the story of Christ has been one of persecution against the Jewish people. I mean, that's all that most Jewish people know about Christ, that he's the persecutor of the Jews.
Right.
So this explains that, how it happened. And it gives some sense to something that otherwise seems senseless. I mean, how could a Jewish prophet from Israel spawn such hatred against the Jewish people? It doesn't make any sense. So I think this type of a thing is much less problematic for Jews to accept than for Christians. And I guess that's also part of what I was trying to say, or had in my mind when I was saying that no matter how many modifications are made to Christian teaching and preaching and theology, unless the foundation is changed, unless the whole system is changed, it won't actually return to a biblical point of view. And one of the evidences of this is what Bobby was saying. It in a sense, it doesn't matter how many sermons there are about, you know, the Jewish roots of Christianity or anything like that. These concepts are so entrenched that if you do try to talk about something like this to someone, you will find a great deal of hostility. And not, by the way, only among Christians who have no messianic understanding. Even among Christians who have a strong Jewish understanding, some of them, and even among Messianic Jews who have a strong attachment for one reason or another to Christian ideas. In fact, I've encountered some Christians who are more open to these ideas than some Messianic Jews, just because of their own personal stories. So these ideas are so deeply entrenched, people associate them with what the Bible actually says, that it's very, very difficult to bring about a fundamental transformation in outlook. And I think that we're really only scratching the surface. I mean, this book provides a basic outline, and it provides a few examples. But if we were to get all of that junk out of the way, in other words, if we were really to throw away 2,000 years of bad interpretation, almost 2,000 years, then we could actually read the text and see what it says, you know? Mm-hmm. I think we hardly ever do that. We have so much theology, so much interpretation already. We already know what it says, so we don't read it. And we have bad translations which prevent us from really reading it and understanding it fully. So my hope would be that at a certain point we can stop talking about all this kind of stuff, because people will understand that it resulted from mistranslation and misinterpretation, that some elements of truth obviously came through, but it was mixed with a lot of falsehood, a lot of misunderstanding and misimpression of what God was saying. And if we don't have to talk about that anymore, we can actually talk about what the scriptures do say and the words of life that Yeshua did bring, you know, and what God actually wants to communicate to us. So unfortunately, because it has been so long and because history has been so convoluted and the main people who carried on the idea of belief in Jesus were not Jews remaining faithful to a Jewish understanding, but Gentiles who didn't have a Jewish understanding, because of all these things, were very far removed from the original. And it's very complicated to look at even a single issue like the congregation of the Lord, for example. I mean, that was, I don't remember which chapter that was, maybe chapter 2, where we talked about ecclesia. But there's a good one to try on your Christian friends, you know, to convince them that ecclesia doesn't mean church and that there's no church in the Bible. Some people might be open to it, but definitely the majority would not be. And it's not their fault. It's how they've been raised. It's the entire structure of thought and so forth. But what I'm saying is that until we can get rid of all those concepts, and it's hard to get rid of them because you have to go through all these complicated analyses of original language and translation and so forth, and people won't necessarily believe it, and they'll object to it. But until we can...
You're going to call all these buildings that are all over the place.
Yeah, there's another problem. But until we can get rid of all that stuff, we won't be able to actually just read the words that God has given us and come to an understanding of what He wants to say.
The thing that I hear most often when someone finds out that I'm a Jewish believer in Yeshua is, I thought the Jews rejected Jesus and they kicked Him to the curb. Or I thought they rejected Jesus and crucified Him. How can you believe in Him? And I don't know if the other Jewish people here get that as well. But I spend hours trying to explain to people it was a small number of people who rejected Him. You know, they really have this idea that every one of the Jews threw Messiah out, threw Yeshua out, and only the Christians followed Him. There weren't even Christians over there.
Right.
There were no Christians.
But it's very, very hard to convince anyone otherwise. And that's why this book has been written. That's why we're discussing it. It's not an easy task. I mean, another objection that's often raised is, oh, well, then if you believe in Jesus, you're a Christian. And it's very difficult to dissuade anyone of that understanding also. So, yeah. Yeah.
You know, Dave and I had talked about this one time, and I said, before you were a believer, I asked him, did you know that Jesus was a Jew? He said, no, he's a Christian.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, I assume that most people in Messianic congregations know this, but we could review that a little bit. You know, the basic understanding that most people have of Jesus is as of someone who's non-Jewish, or if he was Jewish, who betrayed his people and started something new. Some people, a minority, have the more academic viewpoint that he was a Jew, and he lived in Israel, and he had Jewish ethics and so forth, but it's a minority. Most people think he's the founder of Christianity. Most people think his followers were Christians. And they associate what they see as Christianity today or in any other time period as being the teaching of Jesus, when most of the time it had nothing to do with what he taught, or very little at least. So these types of conceptions persist, and sometimes in our circle it might seem like quibbling over small details, but in terms of how the world actually views these issues, it's not a small detail. It's a monumental thing. What's described in this book is basically something that everyone in the world knows to be false. You know, so it's not just for us. The goal is to bring about a shift in how people think about these issues, that is one that is closer to the truth. And that has the potential to change the world. Now, I don't think that there are millions of people lining up at the door to try to discover this new interpretation.
But just try to share with the Christians that the New Covenant writers, the Messianic Covenant writers, were all Jews.
Or that the New Covenant is made with Israel, with the Jews.
No, that, not that's with the church. Out of the question. But just explain that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, all of them were Jewish people writing. And they are just confounded by this.
But see, if someone doesn't know that the New Covenant is made with Israel, they have a misconception about what God has told them about who they are.
Yep.
And this persists because there are so many Christians and so many Christian denominations and seminaries and Bible schools and pastors and sermons, and they all reinforce the wrong conception. But it's, from God's perspective, a wrong conception.
Is there a way to bring to light more of the Hebrew basis of understanding?
Well, I mean, I don't know if there's a way to bring it to the whole world, if that's what you're saying. But I mean, this is what our group is about, in a sense. You know, an attempt to correct some errors. It's not... something that can happen overnight, and it's probably a rare person who's even interested in this kind of an issue, first of all, mm-hmm. and an even rarer person who's willing to consider the claims in this book, and then an even rarer person who will consider them and accept them and maybe try to spread them. So, I mean, my father is one person. He's invested a lot of time and effort to investigate things. Things that, by the way, he would not claim to be expert in the way that a lot of other people are experts in these things. These are things that the experts should know. And in some cases they do, as I pointed out in some classes. If you look in a standard Bible dictionary, you'll find a lot of the exact same things, but they're just not taught that way. You'll find in a standard Bible dictionary, for example, that presbyter is a bad translation of presbyteroi because it didn't have the same religious, you know, ecclesiastical symbolism. That's an argument that's made here. You can find in any standard concordance that ecclesia, that church, that ecclesia does not mean church. If you look at the definition, it'll tell you what it means and it'll show you the places where it's used, and you know it can't be used to mean church in places where it refers to pagan mobs. So all of these things are, again, issues that are available to Christian scholars in particular, but to all people, in fact, because of, you know, what's available to us in the 21st century now. It's amazing the resources that we have. But no one believes it.
And I don't think there's any one little piece of this book you could just go to a Christian person and say, see, this is what we're talking about. It's like people ask me, well, how do you witness to a Jewish person? What's the one scripture I have to share? Or what's the one passage I need to really point out to them? And there is none. Just as many Jewish people have come to believe in Messiah from Old Covenant scriptures as New Messianic Writing scriptures. It depends on where they are in their process of getting to know God. There's no small, easy way to do this. But being well-versed in how this all came about is the overall picture of it, which is what's important, that you could explain it to somebody who, like Isaiah said, the rare person who might have an interest in it, but certainly for our own edification on how the scriptures got to be what they are in the terms of the world. And it's just little nuggets to send out to people everywhere.
This should be taught in Bible schools.
But what's the focus of a Bible school?
The Bible schools are promoting a particular brand of Christianity.
Correct.
The Bible schools won't teach this unless it becomes accepted by the people who teach at Bible schools. Right. And it's not accepted right now. It's very much rejected. Even, again, if the specific points are in their own sources. It's rejected because it's a challenge to the entire system. And you can't just, if you understand that, you can't just get rid of this or that misinterpretation of this or that verse. You have to change the entire structure that you've been operating in. And not only you, but all Christians for all time. And so that's why it's compared to the Copernican Revolution. Now, Copernican Revolution in some ways was much simpler. because Copernicus made a very simple assertion. This has a lot of complicated assertions in a sense. Copernicus said the Earth goes around the Sun instead of the Sun going around the Earth. Now, they didn't teach that in the Bible schools of his day, and they were opposed to teaching it. And his revolution was not successful because he went out and told everyone about it, and everyone agreed with him. It was successful because eventually, over the course of decades and centuries, enough people gradually came to see that he was right, even though everyone said he was wrong, that the prevailing authorities changed their viewpoint. That hasn't happened yet with this kind of a thing. So, you know, it's in the initial stages of a revolution, if you want to use that analogy.
So, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask, what is the most accurate translation to your opinion?
French.
Yeah, this one.
It hasn't been written yet.
It hasn't really been written yet, because there's no translation in English from Judeo-Greek. From Jewish Greek. And there isn't really a translation in English from Koine Greek either, as I mentioned a few times. All the translations are from Christian Greek, something that didn't exist until later, and which already imbues backwards all of the concepts of Christianity into the text. So if you work from the other way, if you work historically, and look at the concepts as they developed from before the texts were written, not the concepts as they were after the texts were written, you get a different flow and a different understanding of what the text actually says.
So when do your father is going to finish this translation?
Well, he's working on it, but it's a big project and it requires help from other people.
Where is he? What chapter is he?
Well, he's gone through the whole text a few times, but
He's
not satisfied with the version that he has.
About done.
I don't know if he's about done.
Writers are never about done.
I mean, he's not in the Gospels. If he has gone through the whole,
right,
you know, New Covenant, or
yeah,
let's say.
But I mean, you have to understand that it's a very serious task and very complicated, especially for someone who's not an expert in Greek, you know. But it's complicated anyways, and all translation is complicated. And really, people should, you know, be referred back to the original languages, because especially if they're going to view it as God's word, because no matter how good the translation is, it will lose a lot. And you will get misimpressions just because the structure of the language is different from one language to another. Some languages, for example, have gender. So all words are masculine, feminine, or neuter. English isn't like that. You know, a table is not masculine or feminine. So some things that could be said in another language on the basis of a table having gender can't be said really in English. And you might get a misimpression in a translation. Just simple things like that, which occur in every line of any text that's in a foreign language. So no translation is going to be perfect, ever. And when it comes to the Word of God, it's a very heavy thing, I think, to try to render it into another language, especially after such a space of time.
There's a company or a big organization that translates Bibles into different languages.
Wycliffe Bible Translators?
Yes. Now, what version are they using as their base to translate from? Are they using one of the English
Bad
translations already, or are they using...
I believe they work from the Hebrew and from the Greek.
Okay. That's unusual.
Do they have an English translation from Wycliffe?
Well, didn't Wycliffe do one? Hundreds of years ago.
Well, I was just wondering what it was. I don't know what it was. I wonder if it was any good.
Yeah, I don't think they're aware of most of these issues.
Right.
So
I don't
probably
still translating
tradition,
it back.
In terms of like translating Ecclesia into church.
Right. Do the translators of Wycliffe know Hebrew or Greek, you know, like they should? If you're translating into a New Guinea language and you're an expert in that New Guinea language, chances are you probably weren't schooled in the ancient languages, and you have to depend on other people.
Right, right. I know some people with Wycliffe that are working on Hebrew translation tools and aids, you know, from someone who is more of an expert with Hebrew. But a lot of their translators out in the field, they have Bible school education as far as, you know, Hebrew goes or Greek goes.
and they're on the field learning the new language, the target language. And so they're doing the best they can with their limited experience.
And it's an urgent job. You can't wait until somebody, you know, like a bureaucracy.
They do as much as they can, as soon as they can.
Well, I don't want you also to miss what Isaiah said before, is that this is the beginning of the revolution. You people are revolutionaries. You are going out and spreading the truth of the true Jewish roots of the gospel and of the Messiah. And so that's kind of exciting that you know that you're in on the bottom floor here.
Well, I think actually several decades ago, some of this got underway with the idea of the Jewish roots of Christianity and the idea that Jesus was a Jew and his first disciples were all Jews and so forth. Those ideas started propagating several decades ago.
Revolutions take a long time sometimes.
You know, so I think that's more when it started for us, and that we want to continue it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, yeah.
I have a question about the writer, your father.
Mm-hmm.
When did he become a believer? Was his parents believers?
No, his parents were not. He was raised Jewish, without faith in Yeshua. Okay. So in the 70s, he mm-hmm. came to believe in Yeshua.
Yeah. When a lot of Jewish people were, right, there was sort of a swell back then.
The Jesus movement.
Yeah.
Right. Affected the Jews,
right.
too.
Now, just on your comment, I think obviously that's true. I mean, there have been trends for 200 years about, you know, recovering the Jewishness of Jesus and the writers, and in various spheres of activity, some of them in Christianity, some of them in academia. Mm-hmm. It's still continuing in academia, mm-hmm. by the way, after having discovered the Jesusness of Jewishness now, academics are slowly starting to think that maybe Paul was Jewish too.
Just me.
Not in the sense of his origin, which they understand, but in the sense of his actual ideas and understanding. You know, it's one thing to recognize that Jesus is a Jew by origin. It's another thing to say his ideas are Jewish. It's one thing to recognize that Paul is Jewish by origin. It's another thing to say his ideas and his writings are Jewish. So slowly that's coming about. The same thing in Christianity. I mean, slowly some of these things are seeping in, and it has been a very long time. And part of the story is Hebrew Christianity, and then Messianic Judaism, and so forth. So there are definitely longer-term factors at work. I want to say two things about that, though. One is that why was there a need for this? It's because the whole world was convinced of what was for centuries, for over a millennia, the standard Christian view, right. which is everything that's argued against in this book.
Right.
So that's why, you know, these modifications are necessary, why they're slowly coming about. Because even people who aren't Christians have these views. Even we've talked a few times about ways in which these views have made themselves evident in Islam. Certainly they're evident in just the general understanding of the person on the street who might not be religious at all. So that's why these movements have been necessary, because of the structure that was set up. The second thing that I want to say is that what's different about this book, and I hope this will also be a growing movement, is to try to cut through the entire system at one blow, one fell swoop, exactly, instead of continuing for 200 or 300 or 500 more years to gradually, you know, sort of understand a little more and more. Mm-hmm. It saying, look, we can see how this arose, this problem. We can see how this problem arose. So let's go back to the source and correct it. And just start from the original. Instead of starting from centuries of misinterpretation and gradually trying to correct it and correct it and correct it and correct it. Let's go back to the original. Let's have a paradigm shift. Let's actually understand the way that God is presenting his word, not the way that people have presented it for so long.
I still have trouble sometimes wrapping my mind around it. And maybe it's like you said, some of it we take for granted. But let's say we're talking to an open Gentile Christian person.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we say ecclesia doesn't mean church, and they say, all right, I get that So what's the, is the basic message just that it's Jewish, that it's all Jewish, or what's, you know, what will we be trying to tell somebody?
Well, it's a good question. I was saying before, it might have been before you got here, that I don't think that's the only purpose of it, just to say it's Jewish. It's, to me, to argue with someone and to say that this is Jewish is like arguing with someone that Abraham Lincoln was American.
Right.
You know, at a certain point, either you accept it or you don't, and you can't really go on for too long. But it may be important, if you're interested in Abraham Lincoln and what he had to say, it may be important to know that he was American. If you think, for example, that he was Serbian and that he was operating in a Serbian context with Serbian issues and responding to the problems of that society, you're going to get a very different impression of him, and it's going to be a wrong impression. So if you just understand that he was American and that he lived at a particular time in the United States and dealt with certain issues in American history, you can understand him much more accurately in the ideas that he's presenting. And it's the same thing here. So the ultimate goal for me is not to convince everybody that it's Jewish. That's the starting point, not the goal.
Is to understand the truth.
Right, it's to understand what God is saying in his word and how distorted it has been, because the most elementary facts about it have been misrepresented.
Yeah. You lived in the 70s, right? About Lake Erie, you know, it's highly toxic, you know. And what do you do about a lake that's accumulated toxins, decades and decades? How do you clean it up? This is the same sort of problem we're facing now. We're at this point of history, and we're looking at this highly toxic lake that calls itself Christianity, and it's not pure at all. It's horribly toxic.
Well, in one of the chapters of this book, my dad describes Christianity as the best of religions and the worst of religions, following Charles Dickens.
Yeah,
it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. And he goes on in the same vein. You know, it brought the world life, light, and hope. It brought the world darkness, death, despair, misery, you know, and it did. And it did all those things. And quite often you can see those things in parallel. For example, in the Holocaust, there was a multitude of Christians who viewed their Christianity as a reason to side with Hitler and to exterminate the Jews and to persecute them to the ultimate end. There were also a very large number of Christians who viewed their Christianity as a reason to risk their own lives, and in some cases give their own lives, to save Jews and to oppose Hitler. So, which is Christianity? I mean, each side would argue this is true Christianity. The fact is that what Christianity has represented throughout history includes both of those. The dominant stream has been one of persecution of the Jews, but there's always been the exception as well. The dominant strain, I would say, even in historical Christianity without regard to Jews, has been one of oppression and injustice. But there's been justice that's promoted through Christianity as well.
Kind of like the remnant principle.
Mm-hmm. Right. So maybe at one point we'll sit around discussing whether the Christians rejected Christ. But we're not at that point yet. So again, the point is not, as I mentioned in one of the other classes, the point is not to tear down Christianity for the sake of tearing down Christianity. The point is not even to say certain things to reduce the chances of anti-Semitism. But the point is to have a truer understanding of what God says. I mean, most of us here believe this is God's word. So,
Well, are there any doctrinal issues that, you know, that we would change in Christianity? Personal doctrinal issues, you know, Christians believe in salvation through faith.
Well, I don't know. I mean, that's a hard question to answer, partly because the way that Christianity defines doctrine is already within the system. You know, you have these specific doctrines about specific issues that are not necessarily the same way that it's presented in the text. So that's one thing. It might be a different way of looking at it. But I guess with all the conceptions you mentioned, they would change shape to a certain extent. Salvation, it takes on a rather different hue. If you look at it from the beginning, Bereshit, forward, rather than from Christian interpretation backwards. And by the way, salvation is mentioned hundreds of times in Tanakh. So that's the place to start if you want to know what salvation is, God's salvation. So that changes. Anything else that you would mention that is a Christian doctrinal interpretation, it's always been viewed that way in Christian theology. There was a new system that was invented to organize and interpret all of these concepts, and they have a particular meaning in Christianity, which is then read backwards into the text. But all of these concepts, if you read them forwards, from what God actually said, the way he laid it out, they have a different flavor, at least. Maybe sometimes a different meaning, too. So, again, it's kind of hard to say everything that would change, because we're still dealing with trying to convince people to get rid of all of this massive misinterpretation. So it's hard almost to throw that away and to start to read it forward. But if, for example, we had, instead of thousands of preachers who have been trained in the Christian way, thousands of preachers who rejected that and started to read the Bible forwards and understand God's concepts, we would have a much better idea of what becomes different in it.
I think you would see some changes too, because one, Christmas, Easter,
yeah,
and the Sabbath, when they celebrate, three man-made doctrines right off the bat that had nothing to do with what's in the Tanakh or what's in the scriptures at all.
Well, I'm not talking about most thoughtful born-again Christians wouldn't say that you have to celebrate Christmas to be Christian, although
right.
If you don't celebrate Christmas, you're deep.
Oh, I don't. I haven't for years, and I am highly suspicious.
Yeah, I know.
By majority of family members and friends, it's like totally weird to them that I'm a Christian who doesn't celebrate Christmas anymore.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
it's like bizarro to them.
I wanted to say something before. Right.
Barry's question: do you think that maybe it's hard with such complex information to be able to pull out key phrases or key points? And I'm thinking to myself, how can I learn better? Do I highlight certain scriptural points that brought this whole issue into question, these whole issues into question, and then maybe do like a flow chart or, you know, those little bubble charts where this is connected to that and stuff like that, just to try to, you know, hammer it home a little better so that when confronted with somebody who comes up with, you know, a frame of reference that's, you know, skewed from what we're learning here, that I have a way of helping them to hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it's so hard for me to learn it. So maybe I don't know if that addresses anything mm-hmm. what Barry was just mentioning, but just in terms of knowing what to say or what are key points.
Right, that's a good point, and that may be helpful for a lot of people. Just one final comment before we close: you shouldn't accept what's being taught here because it's being taught here or because it's in a book. You should accept it if you find it true.
Right.
On the basis of your investigation. So you should look at the evidence that's presented and evaluated and see if you think it is accurate in terms of understanding the Bible or not. And that's the case in every area of life, that we should evaluate and attempt to understand what's true and what's false and not simply accept something just because it's taught by a particular person or in a particular setting. But anyways, thank you. I think you raised a number of good points, which sort of helped to rescue me from my lack of preparation for this chapter. I hope you got something out of it, and hopefully next time we'll be a little more prepared.